Every year there's challenges to getting in the trail. There's not that many people who try to work a full-time job and train for Iditarod, so my time is really, really limited, and I have to be super organized. And when we get a foot of snow, but the swamps aren't frozen up yet, then we have no trail. You know, that kind of thing is a challenge. And then doing it with, you know, not as physically capable as normal, it's a lot harder for me to put trail in now. I'm not very good at wrestling a snow machine around.
Right.
So it's just, you know, everything's a little bit more challenging, but so far so good.
Well, that's great. You know, even though you are the one driving the sled, is it your dogs that drive you?
I think the entire sport and the, you know, the Iditarod in particular is an addiction that drives me. That's what I do that gives meaning to my life. I don't have a family. I don't have kids. But having this huge overriding goal that pretty much, it's a year-round thing. You know, if I'm not training the dogs, I'm thinking about what I need to do to get ready to train for dogs. Yeah, that is what drives me.
Mm-hmm. Great one. And tell me, how are your dogs doing?
They're so good.
All right.
They are amazing. I have a very small kennel. I've only got about 20 in training right now, which it sounds like a lot, but when you need 16 to start a race and you train for 6 to 8 months beforehand, you know, they're not all going to come to the starting line in perfect physical condition, so it's better to have a few more to start with. Just been struggling to keep my numbers up over the last few years, and I think I'll do a little bit better in the future, but it takes a while to build back up when your numbers get down.
I bet. Yeah, and you have your favorites that you, you know, that you might have to have some that retire. And
I've had a lot retire in the last few years, and they've all gone off to various, you know, couches and sofas around the country, which is so hard to do. I always say that's the second hardest part of being a musher is, you know, finding them good homes where they can be happy and retire comfortably.
Sure, I bet it's hard for them. They don't want to quit either, so if they stay on the property and they hear the dogs being tied up to go for a run and they want to go, it just makes it easier to almost find them homes in a new environment.
Yeah, they never quit wanting to go, and it's not really fair to make them sit and watch when they don't get to go. And I have a few that I'll keep forever, and I'll, you know, I do my best to get them out and keep them happy and everything, but, you know, I mean, obviously their happiness and health is my highest priority, so if I can find them a good home. But I have a dog in Virginia who works helping to tame feral cats that are being brought in and tamed. I have a dog in Chicago that, you know, he's learning to do some bike joring and some more hot weather activities. You know, I have dogs all over the country, and I do keep tabs on them, and it's awful sending them off, but then there's always the new crop coming up, so.
Yeah, and tell me about puppies. How many dogs of those 20 are actually quite some coming up from your puppy?
Well, I have 6 2-year-olds, well, and then I bought a few, so I actually have quite a few 2-year-olds, but they all have quite a bit of experience. I don't have any real youngsters this year because I went through a bunch of stuff was going on a few summers ago, and I didn't get any puppies last summer, so. Yeah, that's part of why my team is aging and I don't have enough youngsters coming up, but I'm working on it.
Yeah, right. The breeding, I'm sure, is a whole other huge equation to, you know, successful Iditarod mushers, and it's a real trick of the trade to do that.
Well, I have a really good luck. I have the dogs that I breed end up being the ones that I like the best. I really like my bloodline. I love all the pups that I end up raising. They're just fantastic, and they're almost 100% completely successful. But I don't breed very much. I don't think it's responsible to just keep having litter after litter. And so if I miss 1 year, that makes a big dent in my program.
I bet. Well, it's good to know when you have to, you know, delegate some things to other people. And let's, you know, there's a little bit more expensive to buy some. But then again, the time is valuable as well.
Right. It's hard to find a good dog, though. There's not a lot of people selling good dogs. They'll sell the mediocre ones. So, sometimes I have luck buying dogs, and sometimes I don't. But I got a few dogs from Lance Mackey last fall, right before I got injured, and didn't get a chance to run them much. But, boy, I really like the looks of them this year. They're pretty nice dogs.
Oh, good. Well, that's always fun to kind of see a little bit of differences in the team as well from different litters, and they look different.
Oh, and they're very, very different in personality, how they move, how they react to things. Yeah, it's interesting to see how big a difference it makes. Depending on bloodlines.
I bet so. Okay, so let's talk a little bit. We've talked about your dogs, and let's talk about you a little bit. It is obvious that you, let's see if I can read my own writing. It is obvious that one of your greatest strengths is your mental toughness. How do you keep in check and balance that you do not push your physical self and risk the possibility of having a re-injury to your back?
Oh, I don't really think I keep myself in balance very well. I do what has to be done, and I have these goals, and I'm going to do what I can to reach them. And if I find that I can't, then I won't. But so far, it's kind of just a matter of how much am I willing to put up with. And I don't think I can't really re-injure. Fractures are healed. What I do have is a, massive lot of scar tissue. All the muscles in my torso were torn and ripped, and well, it hurts, but I'm not going to re-injure it.
Okay, well that's a good picture, a mental picture to know, that you just kind of have to suffer through the pain of stretching out those ligaments or whatnot. Do you have to wear a brace when you are training, or do you just
I'm not wearing a brace or anything like that right now. The biggest thing that I think I'm the most worried about is just that I'm really not strong. I lost all my core strength. I was completely immobilized for almost 5 months, and boy, that does not come back fast. So I'm really not strong, and I'm definitely not fit. I haven't been able to run for over a year, well, almost a year now. I haven't been able to do most of the physical activities I'm used to, so I'm just not strong. And one thing it takes to run Iditarod is you got to be strong enough to hang onto the sled and maneuver it and take care of the dogs. And if there's any risk that I'm not going to be able to control the situation, then I can't put the dogs in that situation.
Right. So obviously, you signed up before the Iditarod deadline, which is December 1st. That was, I'm sure, quite a commitment. You didn't want to wait till the deadline. You said, "I'm going to do this, and here's my money." Here we
Right.
go.
Well, I didn't sign up in June on the first day. I waited till I was doing a little bit of four-wheeler training in the fall to see, I figured if I could handle the four-wheeler training, at least there was a chance I could handle the sled training. But we usually don't even get on sleds until after the deadline, so I couldn't exactly wait and see could I drive a sled very well. And I still don't know. I just, I'm handling most things pretty well, but it's real different driving a four-wheeler with a team than it is maneuvering a sled.
I bet. So, and now, that was one of our other questions, is with the recent snow that we've had, how does that affect the ATV training? And are you all looking, all the mushers talking about where there is snow in the state that you can travel to?
Well, none of our swamps are frozen. It's been such a warm fall, and so then when the snow on top of that kind of makes a mess for us. We can't really get out and get on our winter trails yet, so we're still stuck with the four-wheeler training. And working full-time, I don't have the option to just jump in the truck and take the dog somewhere better. I can get away on weekends, but that's a big challenge. So right now I'm actually stuck with a 10-mile four-wheeler loop, which we've been going around and around and around, and it's not the best training I've ever done, but we're getting the miles. So
Good.
that's just one of those things. We make it work.
Well, that's really you are really inspiring to, as an example of things may not all be perfectly lined, but you got to keep pressing on.
Yeah, well, I whine plenty in my own head, but I try to keep my mouth shut about it.
Oh, well, do you have someone that joins you on some of your runs as well?
Well, I do have a handler, and that's a full-time helper, and she's really great with the dogs. And she came in not having been around sled dogs at all, but she's learned a lot in the last few months, and she's really capable of handling her own team on a four-wheeler. So we're able to both get out, except, one of the four-wheelers broke down last week, so it's always something.
Yep, time to pull out the tools again and decide if you can do it or you have to hire somebody.
Well, I fixed it a couple times.
Well, good for
Obviously did a
you.
real good job, so now it's in the shop.
Right. Oh, well, it's good to know when to let the professionals take care of that and you take care of what you're best with, which is your dogs and taking care of yourself.
Right,
Now,
and very, very limited time on my part because if I'm not at work, I'm out on a team almost every day, and there's not a lot of time for me to tinker around with stuff that's broken. That's what
sure.
summer's for.
Right. Well, that puts me to my next question is, how, with all of these hours, the demands of a full-time job, a commute to work, and then a dog yard to take care of, which now you've told me you have a handler to help, which is great. How do you find the motivation to train?
Well, I kind of alluded earlier that's a little bit of an addiction, and I don't really think about anything else. It's constantly on my mind, and if the dogs aren't running, I'm nervous, I'm twitchy. If it's a day we were supposed to run and we, for some reason, can't get out, I can't relax. So I don't feel like I have a lot of control over it. It's just, this is what needs to happen, this is what's going to happen, and trying to figure out a way to make it happen. And the dogs are so happy when they're running, and that's kind of my meditation. To get out there, no matter what stresses and things happen at work or whatever else was going on, you know, after about an hour behind those dogs, just watching them work, and they just love what they're doing, and it's peaceful. Even on the four-wheeler, it's calm and peaceful, and that's where I relax.
That sounds wonderful. I bet with the new snow, just kind of hinting that winter is going to show up this year, that makes sense that that's the highlight of your day.
Yeah, absolutely.
And are you wearing a with the shortened days too? I'm sure a lot of that is through headlamps. Do you have a headlamp sponsor this year?
I don't have any sponsors outside of, you know, friends and family. It all comes in about $100 at a time. So
right.
I keep thinking, you know, someday some company is going to see some great value in, you know, helping out, but
right.
Not really so far. But yeah, you know, the funny thing is like I spend so much time running dogs in the darkness, whether I'm racing or training or whatever else. I can tell you stories about things that have happened out on the trail. And if you ask me, was it daylight or darkness? I probably won't remember. I won't have a clue, unless, you know, maybe the headlamp got torn off or something like that. But for the most part, I don't really pay attention to whether it's dark or not.
Right. Well, that's a great quality of a musher, because you guys are working around the clock, you know, 24/7, whether it's when you are actually racing. So that makes a lot of sense.
Right. Yeah. And it helps to have a good headlamp.
Yeah, in backup batteries, in your pockets, warmed up, ready to be changed out.
Right, backups on top of backups, everything. You know, you got to have at least two of everything out there, it seems like.
I bet so. I mean, a lot of the, you know, the races, I see that you are signed up for the, the Northern Lights 300 and the Testamina, is that how you say that?
Yeah, the Testamina 200. Those are two of my favorite races. I absolutely love the trails, the people who put them on, they're great races. And they're a good test for, usually I'm thinking it's a good test to see where the dogs are, but this year in particular, it's going to be a good test to see where I'm at.
I bet so. And that's probably going to, you know, help you to see, you know, you had mentioned about just the differences of training and then also being at the race pace. And, you know, as for you with this work schedule that you have, it sounds like being out on the trail in a race might be a little vacation, because you don't have to get up and go to work.
Mentally, it's a vacation. It's so nice not to have to think about anything but the next mile of trail or the next, you know, chore you're going to take care of with the dogs. That part of it's really relaxing. But the physical, it's you know, racing dogs is grueling. It takes it out of you. It really does beat you up. And I always say anybody who runs dogs, you know, in distance racing has to kind of like pain a little bit, or at least be really tolerant of it. I'm just expanding my horizons in that direction this year.
Yeah, it sounds like you are. And so this kind of leads me to my next thought of how influential are your doctor's orders?
What orders?
Yeah, you know.
I don't think I have any. Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I guess it has been. Has it been a full year since the?
Oh, it's coming up here. Yeah.
Uh huh.
A couple more weeks. So yeah, it's been almost a year. I was doing physical therapy 3 days a week up until recently, but I can't afford to keep going to that. So, yeah, we'll see how that works.
Yeah, well, you obviously have, you know, you running dogs is your passion. It's what drives you. It drives your gears in other areas of life. It's a lifestyle, and you know, wanting to, when you got taken out, you know, out of your own, I don't know how to word this, but just, you know, having that tragic accident, it took you out of something that was just going along so great. There's obviously a tremendous drive just to get right back into that mode. And, you know, the beginning might be the hardest part, but then maybe even a year from now, you know, this is, you know, the comeback year is probably challenging. But then, do you try to look in the future? of, okay, this is hard now, but it's just going to get easier later? Or are you just looking at things day by day?
I think this year is going to tell me a lot about what I can expect. It's been almost a full year, and the physical challenges that I have are probably not going to change significantly over the years. So I have to see what I can do with what I have left. You know, I'm always going to have pain. I do have some, nerve issues here and there. I've got a few other things going on as a result of the accident, and they'll probably never go away. So as I look at people like Lance Mackey, who has been through, his body has been through so much through his cancer treatments. I look at guys like William Clayton. He's out there running with a prosthetic leg. I mean, those guys can do it. I probably can pull it together and do it.
Yeah, great. It is a sport full of, just amazing stories of overcoming the odds. And you now are becoming one of those people that people look at as someone who overcomes the odds. So really, you are a great inspiration to all of us, more than you may realize.
I don't really realize. I get really stuck in my just grinding away. Like today, I have 4 things on my list, and I've got to run dogs, and I'll probably be in bed around midnight. I don't think about that. And it's a little bit strange, really.
Yeah.
Because I'm the person that I'll go to a party and I'll sit in the corner and pet a dog, or I'll go out, down to Dalkeeton every so often for music, but I don't interact socially with a lot of people very much.
Right.
I'm a little bit of a hermit.
Yeah, I know. And it is interesting, I understand you have a Facebook page, and how sometimes, there's more that people, know about you than you really care to realize that, and I think that a lot of us find that with the social media, and there's some that are too afraid to even go down that road, and some like it and get a lot of strength from it, which it's nice in that sense. I think
I will say I'm always surprised. I'll put just some random comment on Facebook and I'll get a huge response, and the vast majority of it are people who are Iditarod fans and that I don't personally know, and that's a little bit weird. Every so often somebody will recognize me and ask how I'm doing or ask for an autograph, and that's just like, wait, what?
Yeah.
It doesn't quite seem right, but to the extent that people in Alaska particularly love mushing and love Iditarod and support it, that's really cool. And the outpouring of help and support and just well wishes I got when I was injured was really an eye opener. And there was a lot of people that stepped up and did a lot of really nice things. So that was pretty great.
Well, that is great. It really, I think that there's a lot of, mushing is a solitary experience. And so I'm sure that does come shocking to you that, oh, how do these people even know me? I'm just either feeding my dogs
right,
or out in the
right.
trail or commuting. So I can
right.
see how that could be kind of taking you surprising.
But outside of lots of contact with Facebook and all these other things, I will go for weeks without really speaking or interacting with other people outside of my handler and a couple people at work. It is a very solitary lifestyle,
and that's not a bad thing. Sometimes the more I'm around people, the more I want to be around myself, but it's got to be a good balance.
Yeah, and I definitely think there are times when the isolation, and it's not as if I live way out in the boonies, but I don't really live near anybody else. It can be kind of isolating. I don't notice it so much this time of year, but other times of year, I'm just like, wow, I need to get a life.
Yeah, sure. Oh, gosh, and that is a lot of Alaskans, whether they're focused on something, sometimes maybe that desire and that addiction to being on a goal with Iditarod is a way to avoid some of the, side effects of living in a northern climate, where in the winter, a lot of people do get down and out and get bummed out by, not having, just let's face it, days are short, and getting outside always makes you feel better. So I can see how you really are addicted, or just, I can see how it just brings out the highlight of your day is getting out and enjoying your team on the road, on the trail.
Yeah, it's pretty wonderful. And anybody who loves dogs, they have to understand, like, I don't have just one or two. I've got, 20 or more. But they're just as important, maybe more important. You go out on the trail and you push your limits and you struggle together and you work together as a team, and there's a bond that develops. It's a lot different than the bond I've had with dogs that were just pets. Something pretty amazing happens out on the trail when you work together, and that's, to me, the bottom line. That's the biggest draw. There's a lot of parts about mushing that I really love, but that connection with the dogs is, that's the bottom line.
That is a great quote, and I'm just going to write here at 15 minutes into the conversation that that will be a good one to use, because that really sums it up.
Yeah, mostly people in Alaska get it, but there are people all over the world who really think that we're just using the dogs as tools, and I just don't think you could raise these animals and live with them and work with them every day and not care.
Sure, yeah, and that when they, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, just their favorite dogs and on the team and the leaders that pull you through certain situations. And, you know, you hear about even out on the Iditarod Trail when storms come in, and was it Scott Hansen when he was injured and how his dogs had wrapped themselves around him. And those stories are just incredible. And I think people love hearing those kind of stories of that connection of the musher with his team.
Right. You know, that's one thing. You know, Iditarod does a video every year, and people love it, but they focus on the sporting aspect of it, who's in first, who's in second, and they don't tell a lot of the stories about the dogs and the connections with the mushers and the things, the crazy things that happen out there, the things you see and experience. They don't cover that a lot, and I feel like that's what people are really interested in.
Yes, the challenges of the trail, the struggles, the, you know, yeah, what is behind those finishes and those times and so forth. Maybe you ought to, you know, there's always a future in commentating on some of these trails. And if down the road you ever are doing that, you would be a great person to highlight that.
I spent 3 hours doing a live broadcast of the start last year, and it was the craziest experience ever. And I never did it once. Ever anything like that ever before, and you know, I had a lot of fun, and I managed to make it through 3 hours without dropping the F-bomb, which is a miracle for me. Oh, it was fun, but boy, I can't see sitting back and watching other people do what you want to do.
Right.
'Cause I'm like those old retired dogs, you know. I might not be physically up to it forever, but I don't think I'm going to be able to watch everybody else go and not want to go with them.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I almost hesitated to even bringing that up, so that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, picking up the sports journal, something that you were good at, and being like, look at those guys, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, the sport does change over time, too, and it's changed a lot, even since my rookie year, significantly. And I can't keep up with these guys that have refrigerated treadmills and, you know, time to go do whatever they want. And, you know, it's not all about unlimited money, but a lot of it does come down to time to train them the way you want to train them. And I'm going to do the best with what I've got and have fun with it.
Well, that's great. And that's really all you can do. And that's, you know, I like this, kind of like the organic versus inorganic training methods. Is your dog hooked up to a treadmill, or are you out on the trail? Well,
right, and I think, boy, wouldn't that be boring if we did all our training inside of a treadmill?
My goodness, you know, and I know that a lot of athletes that have been at any sport for, you know, even 5 to 10 years or more, you know, boredom is sometimes the biggest challenge. And when viewers on TV or fans see them in the moments of glory, you know, you can think, how could there ever be a boring moment in that? But that's something that really...
Oh, boy, you should try running down the Yukon River for a couple of days. There's nothing to look at, and the trail isn't challenging, and you can only sing so many songs.
Oh, yeah, I bet so. Well, you know, speaking of that, let's talk a bit here, the last bit of our interview, about the trail. And maybe some of your favorite memories out on the trail, of some of the high points. Give me maybe a story of your high point, and then we'll follow up with a low point.
Oh, geez. All right. Hold on. Let me think, because there's so many to go through. I would say, you know, in every race, there are high points and low points. And I don't feel like I go through as many, like, highs and lows as a lot of people. Or, you know, the stories that you hear about people just being completely depressed. But I remember my rookie year, we were going across the Norton Sound, which is frozen sea ice. And, you can't see anything. It's white ice. The sky is kind of white. The sun is shining, and you know, there's nothing to look at for hours and hours and hours. And I just felt like we were crawling. It was before we were allowed to use GPS, so as far as I could tell, we were walking, and we were probably going about 5 miles an hour. And I'm thinking, like, we're never going to get there. It's going to take us 12 hours to get across this ice. We're going to, you know, by the time we finally trudge our way into Nome, they'll have already taken the arch down, and everybody will have packed up and gone home, and we'll just come in into this, you know, dead town with nobody around, you know. And I was just really moping to myself and, you know, scolding the dogs and trying to get them to hurry up, and it didn't help at all, you know. And I just, oh boy, I was just dragging across this ice for hours and hours and hours. And we got to the other side, and one of the vets who's been out there for years and years, Jerry Vanek, he said, "Your dogs look fantastic." And I said, "What?" And he said, "That was a really fast time. You really came across faster than most teams." And I said, "What?" And I said, "I was feeling like I needed to take extra break over here." And he looks at me and he goes, "Oh, the sea ice got to you. You'll be fine." You know? And it just, you know, so much of it is perception and not having a frame of reference on the trail sometimes. And I learned a lot from that experience.
Oh, I bet. Gosh, that's a great story there, Karin. I can imagine how almost the dogs could feel your energy pick up too. And they do, I bet, feel when you get a little lift, and they feel a little lift too.
There is a pretty organic connection there, yeah. And so it's you can't just pretend to be happy and upbeat. You really have to get there somehow to keep your dogs going. Sometimes when the going's tough, you just have to believe.
That's another good quote there. I like that. Well, how about when you did get into town, had it shut down like you thought it had?
No, there was quite a party going. Nome is pretty infamous for what happens at the end of Iditarod. It's a little bit crazy.
What goes on Nome stays in Nome.
Well, it just never shuts down.
Yeah, incredible. It is that the fans are, you know, a real big part of the race. The race is really about, you know, you all out there with your dog teams and all the volunteers, but the fans are a big part of it. And how is that on the beginning of the race when you're going down Long Lake? I've seen you there, and I thought, boy, you know, some of these mushers look like they just can't wait to get out from the people. But how is that for you?
It's, you know, my rookie year, I'd never been out there. I had no idea. It went on for hours and hours, and the worst thing was I really had to pee, and there was just no break in the parade. Like, there was traffic and people everywhere.
So, oh, that's a good
one. I don't know. It's just that's the first part of the race. The first day is there's people everywhere and, you know, crowds and cheering, and it's kind of fun, but it's hard to get your head into a sort of race mode until you get past all that.
Uh-huh. Right. You're like, what is with all this hoopla? Okay, what am I focusing on here? Well, it is, as a fan myself, I love to be down there and see all you go by. It always brings tears to my eyes. And when I see you going down the trail with your team, knowing that there's not just this flat, open lake, you know, thinking of the windy turns and the cold and all the challenges that you go through. And always, you know, there's a lot of well-wishing going on that you guys obviously must feel.
And that's a huge contrast between the ceremonial start in Anchorage and the sort of, you know, ceremonial stuff that goes on out in Willow when you're going through all the crowds. You know, it's usually so easy and, you know, no challenges at all, but you're thinking about what's coming, because there's always, at some point during every race, there's some point where I go, oh my God, I have no idea how I'm getting out of this. You know, just every race there's something. And it's just, it becomes, I won't say a life or death struggle every time, but, you know, it becomes really, really difficult, and it's just so easy those first few days, and there's all these people, and it's just happy and like a festive thing, and it's really not that festive when you're out there struggling.
Yeah, I bet so. Yeah, right. And you can't even have a little spare moment in your mind to wander, because it is a very survival situation, and sometimes that mental energy in survival situations, as there have been the last two Iditarods especially, come to mind, of, you know, just that intensity and the need to use your energy and your mental thing for absolutely what counts and what's right in front of you.
Right, and that's the other thing that I've learned, is to just, and every so often somebody will remind me out on the trail when I'm starting to get a little flustered, you know, they'll just be like, well, you can do this next section. And that's what I've had to learn, is you focus on what's next, and it's usually what's next is doable. Although there were a lot of times during, I did about 14 when we had no snow, where what's next was like as much as I could possibly handle. I've never worked that hard driving a team for that long ever before. It was insane. But mostly what's right in front of you is doable.
Well, that's good. Tell me one of your since we're I said I would ask you the worst. What is one of your maybe the just worst memories of something that was almost beyond beyond handling and being not being able to go beyond?
Well, I did around 14 basically from Rainy Pass all the way into almost to Nikolai was the utmost outer limits of my ability. And I have run Iditarods where I'd never crashed once. I've never even tipped over. I've done a couple years where the conditions were kind, and even though the terrain is challenging, I've kept the runner side down. And Iditarod 14, I mean, you couldn't go 10 feet without crashing in certain places, and it was just getting hammered and flinging into trees and getting dragged over rocks, and even when you were on the runners, just trying to stay there was just physically so challenging. I remember it was leaving Rhone, it was probably around 0 degrees, and I was just working so hard. Sweat was pouring off of me, and it was rolling down my face and then freezing and splashing off. And I was afraid to take off my jackets and layers because I needed the padding, I've never worked that hard and just been like everybody I saw later in Nikolai just looked shell-shocked, just traumatized by what did we just do. So, I mean, that one's going to stand out in my mind forever. But there's been other times, I took a wrong turn out on the sea ice one time. Several of us did and went through jumble ice. And, when jumble ice forms out on the ocean, it gets really big. We're talking like school buses and house-sized blocks of ice just thrown around, and trying to drive a team through terrain like that for a couple hours was, I knew I could do it as long as I didn't run into open water. But it was a howling windstorm, and it was crazy, and it was definitely a little scary.
I bet.
I've been stuck in windstorms where I just could not find the trail, and I would have scratched and given up on the race if somebody could have shown me to some shelter. And luckily I pulled my head up and just said, solve this, and figured it out before I did something that stupid. But there are challenges every year. You just never know.
Right. And you just never know, but you just can't help it. You have to go do it again to find out.
Yeah. I would miss not having this kind of a, focus in my life, something to really, it's a year-long goal I work towards every year. And when you spend a year not being able to do it, not being able to do anything, not even being able to really even be involved, and just sort of sitting on the sidelines, that's a pretty big motivation to get back into it.
That is a good quote too, Karin. And I tell you, you do have a lot of support here in the Talkeetna community and beyond, and we worldwide fans and so forth. And it's really exciting to hear your voice and your words, and you're hearing that you're signed up. And we just wish you all the best with your training, and may you keep the runner side down and enjoy the ride.
Oh, thanks. That's so nice of you.